And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. The Earth's carbon dioxide level is 418.96 ppm. That's up 2 ppm from this time last year. If you want to know the date, it's either January 24th, 2022, or it's about 5 million years ago, based on our carbon dioxide levels. And there are 8 years left until 2030. Anyway, you probably know that because of climate change, there's a lot, lots and lots of transitions going on. We talk a lot about the energy transition, where we're hoping to move towards cleaner energies. That implies lots of other transitions in transportation, how we live our lives, where we, what our homes look like, et cetera, et cetera. One of the big things that I believe is in transition is how we think about cities. What's it like to have a city that you can actually live in a sustainable way? And that brings up lots of questions. I mean, you probably know most urban, well, most cities are located near rivers. I mean, look at New York, right? At the mouth of the Hudson River. It's a gateway into the internal part of the country. Cities and rivers have been intimately connected for millennia. But here in the United States, for various reasons, a lot of the rivers that are part of the urban, part of the urban area have been buried for various reasons, literally buried by highways, overpasses, you know, cemented in, put through culverts. There's some new thinking out there that talks about what the word, funny word called daylighting the river. That is to say, to expose rivers that have been buried through decades of accretion of urban construction that just kind of choked off all these rivers. That's an interesting concept. And we are fortunate to have with us today a guy who's actually thought about this and done some poking around to actually see rivers that have been daylighted, as we say. And it's a fascinating intersection between climate change, natural environment, all kinds of stuff. So the guy we have with us is named Miles Howard, who is a journalist and author. He's been published lots of different places. He's a friend of the Climate Minute. This will be his third or fourth appearance, I think, with us. You may remember him from last June. We talked about hiking the Emerald Necklace around Boston. And that's because one of Miles' focus is on sort of the intersection of outdoor living, urban hiking, hiking in all kinds of places. And he has recently started a Substack called Mind the Moss, which you can read regularly, his blog. So we'll put up links to all that stuff. But Miles, thank you so much for coming back on the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, Ted. It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
That's great. So you, most recently, this past Sunday on 23rd, put up a great article in the Boston Globe, the ideas section of the Boston Globe, and it's titled "Set the Underground Rivers Free." So tell me, give me the story. What did you find out? What's the idea that you've got there?
Well, I'll start from the top. A lot of American cities are built atop numerous waterways that silently run beneath our feet, which have been underground for decades at this point. The way that cities were built decades back is, you know, if you ran into a river or a stream where you wanted to put a building or a parking lot, the idea was that you could just put the river into a pipe and stick it underground and overlay it with whatever you wanted. Some rivers were covered up so that cities could expand more easily. Others were covered because sometimes exposed rivers and streams and cities would cause flooding during spring. This was the case actually in part of Boston. If you live here, then you're probably familiar with a elusive waterway called Stony Brook. There's an MBTA station on the Orange Line named after it. There's the Stony Brook Reservation Woods right near Dedham. But, you know, despite living here all these years and getting off at Stony Brook Station innumerable times, I had never laid eyes on this thing. And there's no trace of a Stony Brook anywhere around there. And it was only a couple of months ago when I learned that Stony Brook is actually a real live waterway. It's just that it runs 8.5 miles under Boston through a series of conduits. It starts up at Turtle Pond, right in the Stony Brook Reservation, kind of ripples through there for about 0.5 mile, and then it disappears. And the entire route of this article really was just, I wanted to see this for myself. I wanted to find the point where Stony Brook vanishes from sight. Uh-huh. And, you know, in the intro of the piece, I clomp out into the woods there and actually do that. I kind of bushwhack along the river for a little bit, or the brook, I should say, until it suddenly disappears into the big gaping mouth of this culvert running beneath the Enneking Parkway. And that sort of, and you know, from my own interest and editorially as well, that basically serves as a jumping off point for looking at why cities are now reevaluating having buried some of those rivers and streams and are contemplating digging them up, re-exposing them to daylight and turning them into natural features within a city.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, the image, in fact, there's the pictures of the river just diving into the ground, into a pipe, right? Everyone's seen it. And it's sort of this, I don't know, heartbreaking in a sense to have all there's grass on one side, and then there's just a pipe where it's gone. And this Stony Brook, even the part that you saw, is probably not that big a river. Right. I mean, it's not river is maybe a glorious term for it. It's called Stony Brook because it's
right. I mean, it's a real trickle of a stream. And, you know, there's a sense of there's a bleak sense of watching it disappear into this culvert. I mean, as Julie Wood, the deputy director of the Charles River Watershed Association, said to me during an interview for the story, pretty much the worst thing you can do for a stream is to put it in a pipe. I mean, it basically kills the ecology of that stream right there. So it's sad. But on the other hand, there's kind of a crackle of excitement when you see the opening of this underground river channel. I mean, if you grew up watching movies like The Goonies or Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the idea of this labyrinth of underwater tributaries does speak to something, almost this childlike sense of wonder. And I think that's why a lot of people seem to connect with this story when it launched.
And so the Stony, just in this one particular narrow case, is an example of many, many, many other cases. You're saying there's basically an 8.5 mile pipeline, probably 5 foot diameter cement pipe that goes from near the Stony Brook T station all the way down to the Charles River?
Well, I'm actually not sure if it passes near the T station, but it does run underneath the neighborhood where that station is located. Mm-hmm. Going from the opening at Enneking Parkway, Stony Brook runs underneath Hyde Park, Roxbury, and Jamaica Plain, and parts of the Northeastern campus before emptying into the Charles underground without much fanfare. So, like, multiple neighborhoods are implicated here.
Fascinating, fascinating. So, what can be done about these things? If you say, gee, and again, from a climate perspective, you say, okay, I want my city to be nicer because people have to live there. We have to have pedestrian pathways. We have to be able to get around. What are the options? What sort of things are people thinking about when they encounter something like Stony Brook being buried?
Well, I think that what cities are contemplating when they look at an underground river and ask the question, should we dig this up, is what are we going to get out of it ultimately? And, you know, previously, a lot of the earlier daylighting projects, such as the Providence Rivers being uncovered in downtown, were mostly rooted in recreation and economics right there. I mean, digging up the Providence River allowed the city to build these beautiful cobblestone pathways along it, which is now known as the Riverwalk. They created a Water Place Park, and this is the hosting grounds for the incredible Water Fire Festival that Barnaby Evans created in the 90s. But today, you know, cities are, and I should add too, that all of these developments are, you know, good for local businesses too, because the more people who come to enjoy riverside trails and parks, the more money that they're going to bring into the area in all likelihood. So that's certainly a consideration among cities today. But the additional element that we're really starting to see, you know, over the last 10 to 20 years is climatological concerns, because, you know, ironically, some of these streams and rivers were buried because they used to flood back in the old day. But the floods that cities are dealing with now are on a whole different magnitude from what was happening in the 19th century. I mean, the warming of oceans is socking bigger storms at coastal cities like Boston and New York. And a daylit stream can actually offer more floodwater capacity as well as more green space for a city. In New York, in the Bronx, there's an interesting project going on right now with Tibbetts Brook, which flows under a significant part of the borough. And back when Hurricane Ida hit the city, the sewer system through which parts of Tibbetts has been routed flooded so much that the water spilled out and completely swamped the major Deegan Expressway. So that disastrous event was part of the inspiration for the city committing $130 million to dig up the brook now, is creating more floodwater capacity. And here in Boston, we've seen similar things happen around Starro Drive after storms too, including during Hurricane Ida. And one of the most interesting daylighting projects happening in the U.S. at the moment, which is what I highlight in the finale of the piece, is that final section of the Muddy River that flows through the Emerald Necklace under Starro Drive into the Charles, right around where there's been flooding in some places previously. That's going to be dug up soon and turned into an open air park. So, you really don't have to throw a stone too far to hit an example of one of these projects happening around you.
And just to orient people, the muddy brook, help me make sure I get my name right. The Muddy River is what is kind of flowing through the Emerald Necklace and the Fenway. And that's what then gets put underground underneath the complex of the Storrow Drive and all those exits, and then dumped into the Charles, right? That's the exit of that flow.
Yeah, I mean, the Muddy River is basically the continuous waterway going through the whole Emerald Necklace, starting from Jamaica Pond as you walk deeper into the city. And, it's worth pausing on this for a sec, because the Emerald Necklace and the Muddy River are kind of an interesting example of a preemptive daylighting project, because the necklace was created back when a lot of cities were starting to bury their rivers. And back then, the Muddy River was clogged in a lot of places. There was trash and sewage in it. It was in really bad shape. But instead of just covering up the river, the city of Boston brought in Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect, to come up with a more innovative solution. And what Olmsted decided to do is keep the river exposed, do some excavations in places to improve the flow of the river out to the Charles. And this was hugely effective in cleaning up a lot of the, noxious stuff that had built up in there. So, so in a way, the Muddy River is kind of an example of the alternative today to burying up a river when it comes to urban design. Unfortunately, since Olmsted's initial success, sections of the Muddy River were covered up or routed into culverts later on, even though the majority of it remained exposed. But some of those sections have also been dug up recently, too. There was one place right in front of the Landmark Center where, right near Fenway Park, that was covered with concrete for a while. And in the last, I think it was in 2013, that was excavated as well. So, in a way, we're kind of restoring the Muddy River to what Olmsted initially envisioned going far back.
I think it's a fascinating thing, because the idea of going back to what the Muddy River looked like in, 1392, is not going to happen, right? What we have now is the human engineered Emerald Necklace, right? And so these rivers that we daylight, which have wonderful effects in many ways, are also going to be the result of human engineering. And it just goes to show you where we are in terms of sort of a relationship with nature, because this thing that we're trying to return to nature is going to be something that we are engineering. Is that fair?
Exactly. There's certainly an irony right there, and it speaks to, the line between, just building over everything and, letting letting true nature happen. I mean, this is very much an act of land management, but even within that genre of land management, there are different approaches as far as, do we make this more naturalistic, or do we, cultivate the hell out of this? And, if you go back to some of Olmsted's early park designs, you can see that even as a landscape architect, his approach to a lot of projects like the Emerald Necklace and the Muddy River was to basically let these parcels of green space, grow and flow as naturally as they want to, really. And that is part of the principle of a lot of daylighting designs that we've seen in other cities. I mean, the whole idea is, you're trying to restore the waterway to, something close to its natural flow, where it wants to go. And, in some cases that might, you might be digging the channel a little bit wider or deeper than it may have been previously. But I think that, the idea of, again, sort of letting the river set its own course is kind of the baseline goal behind a lot of these projects.
So, you've talked a little, we've been talking in sort of this on the one level, daylighting, in quotation marks, daylighting a river is good for the city in terms of sustainability, right? It allows you to manage the heavier water flows that we expect to see from heavier rainstorms going forward. It does provide you with sort of economic, like in Providence, where now these are nice places to be as opposed to being underneath an overpass. I guess for my own part, I'm wrestling with this sort of sense of, the sense of joy that I see when there's a statement about a river being uncovered. I mean, I think that what you're touching on is something deeply human, right? And the idea that we can make the river or the brook or the waterway or nature submit to our will and put it in a cement pipe to finally have that broken seems like a good thing psychologically. I mean, do you put any credence in that, or is that a standalone reason why we would want to be doing daylighting, or is it just we just have to be utilitarian to say, yeah, more stormwater?
No, I think it's certainly when it comes to amassing public support and interest in daylighting projects, I think in some ways what you're touching on, Ted, is almost more important than the more nuts and bolts utilities of doing so. I mean, I think that, there's a deep desire in many of us to break down this very rigid dichotomy between, you know, urban and wild. I mean, look at how many people, you know, living in both of those environments, you know, escape for the other here and there. I mean, we've seen decades worth of evidence that, having naturalistic or more cultivated green spaces in urban neighborhoods does wonders for the popularity of that neighborhood when it comes to visitation, when it comes to the happiness of residents there too. And, certainly there are, very tangible benefits, but I think, spiritually, there is something that gets me really excited and even moved when a city consciously decides to rediscover and re-embrace its natural resources right there. I mean, I don't even know if I should frame it as natural resources. It's almost more like, practicing a kind of, respect and humility in front of the land on which this entire project has been built right there. And I think that, as a compass for future, urban development projects going forward, such as daylighting rivers and streams, I hope we keep touch with that. I hope we get more in touch with that in the near future.
Well, that seems like a wonderful place to close our conversation. It's the coolest thing. What I'll do is put up links to the Boston Globe article about setting underground rivers free, and then a second article that has personal resonance with me about the city of Fall River seeking the underground rivers that it has and what's there and what can be done. Dear listener, there's probably a buried river in your own town or that famous stream that you're not quite exactly sure where it is. I mean, my advice is go find out. It might be running behind the Stop and Shop in a cul-de-sac, a culvert for all you know, but it's probably there and it would do your soul good to check it out. As I said, I'll put up links to this stuff on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have any comments about what kind of shows we ought to be putting up, what topics we should discuss, or if you have a hidden river somewhere that only you know about, a Stygian River, I think you called it, right? Buried deep in
the river. That's actually Adam Gaffin from Universal Hub, who I love that. I love that.
That's a great phrase. Let us know about it, and we will do something about it. If you're listening to this show on your smartphone, please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their smartphone using their modern podcast distribution app. We're on a lot of them now. I checked it out the other day. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, which probably means things like a balance of wild and urban stuff, just as we're talking about, a durable future. And because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade, or should I say the next 8 years, under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Miles, thank you so much for, number one, thinking about daylighting of rivers, and number two, taking the time to come on and chat with us about it. It's fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much for having me, Ted. It was really good to be with you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.